Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It is the weekend and everything is going great, right? I mean, what could possibly go wrong? So we've decided to actually double up to give you kind of a mega house stuff going podcast, joined, of course, by my colleague Tim Miller with a special cameo appearance by none other than the Raging Cajun, James Carville. So Mr. Carville and Mr. Miller, welcome to the podcast.
What an honor.
What an honor.
Okay, so
as Lincoln once said about the guy who was run out of town on a rail, he said, "Wouldn't have been for the honor of the thing, I'd just soon walk."
Okay, so let's just start with this, and I'm going to throw this to you, James. How's it going? I mean, how is it going right now? I mean, just a mood check.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. Right now, it's going terribly. All right. There's just not a question about it. It looks dysfunctional. People are arguing over a number, which they never should have done, and arguing over a deadline. However, I think there's a real case for optimism, and I'll lay it out to you. First of all, the virus, you know, really whacked us over the summer, particularly like August and September. It is getting better. More people believe that it is going to continue to get better. And we have a promising therapeutic on the horizon, and they have like three other therapeutics that are pretty seriously in trials. And that happens. There is pent-up demand out there that we can't imagine. I think somebody told me it was $13 trillion in household savings, all right? That explodes. The next thing's going to happen is it's a much better than 50-50 chance that the Manhattan DA indicts Trump before the end of the year on very specific, and it's going to be tuition tax cases. It's going to be very, very specific charges. So the short term is depressing as it can be. The more immediate term, I'm not very much of a Cassandra on that. I think there is a legitimate, all of these events, I think, are more likely to happen than not. Now, maybe all three won't happen, but I don't know. That's my case for immediate term optimism.
Okay, so Tim Miller, your new not my party is time for the Democrats to wake the hell up, in which you take your strange new respect and take it out in the backyard and just light it on fire.
Yeah, it's going. James just described things as about as bad as they could be, and then I listened to his description. I was like, I actually think it's a little bit worse than that right now. So, look, I think that one thing I do agree with James on, which I get to in the not my party, is that there's time to fix this. You know, I mean, there really is time to fix this. It doesn't, you know, the only election happening anytime soon is that Virginia governor's race, right? The clock is ticking. But I think that there are a lot more questions than answers on the economic side. I hope James is right and the spending kicks in next year and we see a boost going into the midterms. And obviously that would be, you know, wins at the back of Joe Biden. But the jobs numbers out today are shit. The bad news about that for Biden is it's more bad news for Biden. The meta good news, I guess, is, you know, the idea that just ending unemployment insurance was going to magically change the economy for the better was, you know, more right-wing punditry BS. But, you know, that sort of meta victory doesn't really do a whole lot to help Joe. I think they need to, you know, we've talked ad nauseum about my view on how they just need to, you know, get the infrastructure thing done. That's obviously not going to happen. So, you know, they have this December 3rd deadline. At this point, you know, I was looking for a hot Joe summer. I think we're just dealing with a cold Joe fall, and they got to look to that December 3 and deal with the debt ceiling, maybe permanently then, have a reconciliation number that has a bill they can actually sell, you know, that has one or two things in it that people like and that people can know what's in it instead of calling it the Build Back Better Reconciliation Human Infrastructure Bill and nobody knows what the fuck's in it except for that it costs a lot of money. I think that if they get that done and they get infrastructure done by December 3rd, and if James is right, we can keep praying to Cy Vance and not Cy Vance anymore. Keep praying to whoever. Who's the Manhattan DA now, James?
He's still the DA.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll do my rosary to St. Cyrus.
All right.
I don't know when the St. Cyrus feast day is. Maybe that's in December too. We can check that out. And it is. You know, I just kind of ride feel the storm like out. But December 3 like is I've been
here before. I feel like I've been here before. Okay, so James, this is, I don't know whether you've seen Tim's video, but he talks about the Democrats beating up on the moderates and everything. And I'm just really struck by the fact that you have the former president who's, you know, moving to launch his 2024 revenge tour. You have the Fox News host, you know, pushing, you know, crazy, batshit crazy racist right. rhetoric and denial. Every day we find out how close we actually came to a coup. And this is the moment when members of the Democratic Party, for the progressive wing, have decided they're going to beat the crap out of the two moderates in the Senate, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, and the progressives in the House are going all Freedom Caucus. At least that's the vibe that I'm getting. What's your take, James Garvell?
Well, first of all, I'm not the most popular person in the world among these people. So, somebody has got to go to bed worried about their Twitter. You know, how many people follow them on Twitter and wake up an American. All right, that's just what's going to have to happen here. And I think eventually that it will happen. On terms of Cy Vance, he said in an interview with the FT that he was going to charge and not charge by the end of his term, which is the first of the year. And I do not believe that a guy like Pomerantz, who's like the best criminal lawyer in the world, is taking off time from his law firm to prosecute a case of tuition tax evasion. Yeah. Right, that's not happening. And that forensic accounting firm they got, I think it's FSIS, I looked them up. You wouldn't want them people anywhere around your finances.
Right? I'm paying my taxes, James. I don't care. They can get in my business.
See, I'm just feeling this is like the waiting for Mueller, you know, moment. I feel like
this is not Mueller.
Okay.
People are making that mistake.
Okay, good.
These are not Mueller. I would bet easy, better than even money, they indict Trump.
Interesting. Okay.
For the
all
first
right.
of the year. I have no inside information.
Okay.
But, by the way, if the guy that has turned out to be a squish so far is Garland, I mean, he's telling people that it is a classic obstruction of justice to tell people not to cooperate with a legally impaneled investigation.
Yeah.
Jesus, man, what do you need?
Well, you know, it is interesting, the sort of the asymmetry that we're seeing here, where Garland, I think, is so obsessed with not being the, you know, kind of the Trumpian DOJ, not being Bill Barr type, that he's leaning over backwards. And you are looking at, you know, all of these obstruction of justice cases, all of this. And I think there's almost no chance that he's going to pull the trigger on all of this.
Well, then they ought to fire his ass.
Okay, so
how are you going to have a country that celebrates the rule of law when you have a president and a former president blatantly, I mean, just blatantly violating criminal statutes?
Just real quick, did you see that Mr. Trump actually complimented Garland last night, which is about all you need to know. He was he knows. I mean, you know, Trump is nothing if not an apple polisher to people that, you know, are doing what he wants at the moment. You know, I always said that the smart thing, the one thing I'd give Trump credit for, the Democrats to understand, is if Charlie Sykes went on Joy Reid's show tonight and said, I've been radicalized, I'm putting on my red hat, and, you know, it seems like Donald Trump was making a lot of sense, you'd be invited down to Mar-a-Lago this weekend. He'd roll out the red carpet. As long as you're being nice to him in the moment, he's nice to you, and he welcomes you into the tent. You know, that is obviously not the treatment that the Democrats are giving Joe Manchin and other people that are trying to get inside their tent. And so, you know, I think it's as simple as that. He sees the Garlands not being tough on him, and so that's just his little lizard brain. So he's not going to attack him.
He's not going to poke the bear. So. Yeah, go on.
Well, let me ask a question. What do these people think they're accomplishing by attacking Joe Manchin?
I said this is on television.
He is a Italian Roman Catholic Democrat in West Virginia, all right? In a state that Democrats have not carried a county since 2008. If you don't have Joe Manchin, you're going to have Marsha Blackmun. Yeah. That's your choice.
That's the best case scenario.
I can't tell you how stupid they are.
Well, can they count to 50? This is my problem. They can't to 50 because, you know, I was watching Bernie Sanders and he's ripping Kyrsten Sinema, he's ripping Joe Manchin. Bernie, I understand you're a cranky old man, but at some point you understand that if you're going to get anything that you want, you need all 50 votes. It's just simple mathematics. If Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema have provided that crucial 50th vote for appointees, for cabinet members, for the budget resolution. The only reason we're talking about reconciliation, you don't have her or him in the Senate. You have Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. So what is the addiction, James, for Democrats to have a circular firing squad?
My recommendation is get a second grade math teacher and talk to the Progressive Caucus and understand the concept of 50, all right? Because maybe some people think that, arithmetic is part of the white hierarchy in the country that, suppresses people. I have no goddamn idea. I can count to 50. I took remedial math twice at LSU, but I can still count to 50.
Yeah, but on Twitter, I wrote a piece, and of course I'm getting the ratio that I expected. And this is okay. This goes with the territory. Tim, you're experiencing this as well. Where I said, maybe you ought to remember that Kyrsten Sinema is not just the swing vote; she's the absolutely essential vote. And everybody's like, screw her. We don't need her. We should pressure her. We should ride her out on a rail. Like, guys, you need her vote for everything, because without her, nothing gets done. For the progressives, there's only two options, right? Right, guys? You either, in the election, you win more elections, you convince more people to vote for you, or you get every single Democrat to go along with you. And I'm not sure that the strategy that we're seeing right now accomplishes either one of those goals.
I agree with you, Charlie, on the strategy, and running into the bathroom and making fun of her for her wine and her bisexuality is probably not a strategy to get her vote. I will say I do put Sinema in a different category than Manchin. Biden just won Arizona. The other senator is also a Democrat who's not creating any trouble. She voted for Ralph Nader in 2000. So this is not like a long-term principled centrist. We don't exactly know what she wants. I mean, Joe Manchin, not only, as James said, is the alternative between Joe Manchin and somebody I would say far worse than Darsha Blackburn, probably a Josh Mandel type. But he also put on paper to Schumer a very reasonable offer, $1.5 trillion. It was going to pay for universal pre-K and continue the child's credit, tax credit, not for rich people. It wasn't everything that the folks are going to want, and it seems like he's willing to negotiate to the middle. But he at least put something on paper, and he's obviously dealing with this very challenging state. Sinema has been extremely inscrutable about what exactly it is she wants. And she's in a purple state. So I understand that potentially there's a strategic play there to pressure her from the left, say you're going to get a primary if you don't get in line, and maybe that would work. That strategy at least makes sense in a way that it doesn't make sense for Manchin. But stay out of the bathroom. Here's my other problem that I'd love to get James' two cents on, since we just get this lovely time together, is like the besides not having a good strategy for dealing with Manchin and Sinema. And in this case, I don't want to pick on the progressives so much as the Democratic establishment. It doesn't seem to me like they have a strategy for expanding the map into red states at all. It's hard to find examples of...
Because you need moderates to win in those states.
Yeah, of candidates that are willing to poke the bear. Look, the reason why Joe Manchin wins is because the people in West Virginia think he's on their team. And their team isn't the team that agrees with every single liberal piety and that's in the K hive and that is going along with every Joe Biden thing. And I don't see any of the candidates that are coming up to run in 2022 doing that. There are a couple of exceptions, but even if you look at your so-called moderates like Connor Lamb, I like Connor. He's running more as like a Mark Kelly moderate than a Joe Manchin, and that might work in Pennsylvania, right? But there's not a lot of where is the creative thinking for dealing with the crisis ahead? And that was kind of the wake up call I was going for. This is a crisis where if the Republicans take the House and the Senate back, and it's a close election in 2024, they might steal the damn election and end our democracy. Right. And so we should probably be trying to be a little bit more lenient about getting people in who are going to be on the right side of that matter, maybe if they disagree. And the Democrats just don't seem to be doing that at all.
All right. I have an answer for you.
Okay, please.
Okay. Let's start with one simple fact. 18% of the United States elects 52 senators. There's your urban strategist.
Yeah.
All right? Wow. We're all huddled together in the same places. Right? Yeah. Now, there are Democratic proposals that are very popular across the board, that Democratic lobbyists kill in Washington. Namely, who would say the government shouldn't be able to negotiate prices for prescription drugs? Yeah. I mean, that's not a conservative or liberal thing. That's just like, well, of course, if I go in and, you know, you buy a lot of something, you get something. For Hertz buys 100 cars, they get a discount. It's just the way the world works. They're forbidden in Democratic lobbyists who I don't know the names of. Somebody's got to name these goddamn people, because you run into them and they go to the events and they all, you know, meshed in with Democratic elected officials. That's an extremely popular thing. But another thing that's popular is raising taxes on rich people. It's got like 65-67% support. And the lobbyists kill that. How do you think we don't have carried interest? And what I think people need to do is find out who these lobbyists are and name them. And say, you're not in the club anymore, dude. There are any number of proposals that Democrats advance that do nicely. In Florida, I never tire pointing out, giving felons the right to vote got 64%. Hmm. All right. Raising the minimum wage to $15 got 67%. That's in a referendum. That's not a poll. That's people going vote. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. You have shit in the Democratic quiver. There's any number of arrows that you can shoot. But you're right. People say, well, they campaign on this. Prescription drug prices are still high. My wages are low. You know, inequality is killing the country. And the public doesn't like this stuff. They're almost demanding it.
So do you guys read Ezra Klein's piece in the New York Times today about David Shore?
I did.
Okay, so just to remind people, David Shore is this brilliant political wonk who actually was canceled when he pointed out that riots actually tend to, urban riots actually hurt Democrats. And people, you can't say that. And
well,
he was
just worse than that, Charlie.
Okay, so
he retweeted. There was an academic at Princeton. He's now in Pomona. And his name is like Omar Wasso or something. All right, and he retweeted. And he, I think the guy is black, actually. Yeah. Right, he retweeted a piece of academic research that says that peaceful demonstrations help more in an election than violent. I mean, that wasn't exactly. You had to go to Princeton to figure that out. And it ran his ass out of town. I mean, that's the brilliance of the progressive movement. All encapsulated.
See, they hate the whole both sides-ism, but I mean, what you're describing here is the is the bubble they've created. Like, we don't even want to hear this academic study that might make us feel slightly uncomfortable, even though it's exactly the kind of warning you need to hear. So, okay. So
he's also like a socialist, by the way. He's not, a James Carville dino.
Well, he's got a way.
Okay. My friend Sean McAwee, they're pretty left, but I would say that Sean and David are probably inching toward pragmatism at some level.
Inching toward it. Okay, so he's got this warning for the Democrats. Ezra Klein has a great column in the New York Times about it. And I'll just read a little bit. So here's the truly frightening thought. I mean, things are bad right now. Here's the truly frightening thought for frustrated Democrats. This might be the high watermark of power they'll have for the next decade. For sure, cancellation, traumatic though it was, turned him into a star. His personal story became proof of his political theory that the Democratic Party was trapped in an echo chamber of Twitter activists and woke staff members. It had lost touch with the working class voters of all races that it needs to win elections, and even progressive institutions dedicated to data analysis were refusing to face the hard facts of public opinion and electoral geography that you've been talking about. And at the heart of Shore's frenzied work is the fear that Democrats are sleepwalking into catastrophe. And he's talking about, the House races, the Senate races, the presidential races, and he's obsessively running these simulations. He's saying, look, the way the structural nature of our politics, the Senate, the way that it is set up right now, if Democrats don't kind of wake up, to use Tim's phrase, they're going to be steamrolled. So, James, you read this piece, and before we started the podcast, you brought it up, and you and I were reading the same thing at the same moment.
Right. Okay. First of all, the Democratic Party, right? They had a choice in 2020. All right. Joe Biden is the most unwoke. You couldn't tell Joe Biden wouldn't know what woke is. You tried to explain it to him. Sorry, I said, what are you talking about, pal? Right? He don't understand it. They had Bernie Sanders, they had Elizabeth Warren, they had everybody, they had all the money in the world. They went every debate platform, and they got slaughtered. They got slaughtered. All right? The same thing happened in Louisiana in the second congressional district primary. The same thing happened in New York City. You couldn't be more woke than Maya Wiley. She never sleeps. She's so woke. Right?
Okay.
And overwhelming, but it is, and I think 22% of the country is on Twitter, probably Democrats, or Democrats, not country, Democrats on Twitter. They're 90% urban under 35, right? They don't win elections. They drag you down, and their votes don't count. Their votes are all in Boston and New York and Philadelphia and Washington and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Seattle, right? They are actually a drag on the party, and they're too stupid to see it.
And I want to just add in on that with a little practicality to talk to the shore thing, because I think particularly, you know, a lot of our more progressive listeners, you know, come here and are frustrated. They're like, oh, you know, it's getting repetitive. Tim and Charlie always want, you know, the Democrats to do what Joe Manchin and these moderates want, because they are, you know, former conservatives, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, guilty. I'm a moderate. I'm guilty. But there are other ways to attack this problem, you know, if you're a Democrat, that kind of speak to what James was just talking about, besides, you know, moderation as it's traditionally thought about, right? And so just think about this for a second. Like, I'm a gay man with a black daughter in Oakland, so I might not be Maya Wiley woke. I like my rest, but I'm pretty woke. So I'm speaking about this just
you
as
are
a strategy.
Not really woke enough, no.
Yeah, well,
you're gonna have to turn in your woke card.
So okay, well, I'm speaking this just as strategy, maybe not my personal preferences, but. If the Democrats want to wedge against the Republicans' new coalition that David Shore lines out, which is rural folks, which is non-college educated, you know, folks across racial lines, by the way, you can take a strategy that goes at them that takes a hard line on the pharmaceutical companies, like James was just saying, that supports, you know, a lot of these big spending ticket items. A lot of these Republican voters, these are not Paul Ryanomics people who joined the Republican Party. They are culturally conservative, and they're responding to, you know, a lot of the, you know, contrarian anti views against the kind of elite established coastal culture. And so I don't know why a Democrat couldn't run in a red state that runs on a down the line progressive strategy, but that attacks the left for, you know, some of their pieties on these cultural issues. Where is that strategy? That would also work just as much as being more of a centrist, you know, on, you know, kind of more traditional sense.
Let me get it. That's exactly what I was saying before, Tim.
Yeah.
I'm not a moderate Democrat. I'm a goddamn liberal. Understand that, okay? I think inequality is gut-wrenching. Climate is about the most real thing that you can deal with. I'm for negotiating prescription drug prices. I'm for raising taxes on the rich. I'm for taxing, you know, capital gains, investment income at the same rate you tax earned income, right? But I'm not crazy. And the Democrats don't need to adopt, you know, some semi-looking Republican positions, and they just need to adopt positions that are right there, like raise the minimum wage, raise taxes on the rich, negotiate prescription drug prices. These things are enormously popular all over the country. And, you know,
so why aren't they doing
and
this?
Campaign on them, by the way. Yeah. Campaign on them rather than campaign on fighting each other. Like, just get them passed and make it very sensible. You know, and again, and look, I'm stealing this from you, James, but like, you don't need to win over every Bubba in the exurbs, right? Like, you just need to start cutting down on the margins by making people feel like you actually care about them again.
And not be crazy and repel voters who you might have rented in the last couple of elections.
I couldn't agree more. And you know who likes this? Inner city people like this. Suburban women like this. People in rural America like this. We spent $100 million last cycle in 77 counties in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And, you know, these were all rural white counties, and we got about a 5.5% improvement, which is staggering.
Right.
Okay. We got the shit beat out of us. Don't kid yourself. We went from losing 80-20 to, you know, 74.5 to 25.5 or something. Okay.
That's
it's very important. And the margins count here. And you give people you're running against Ron Johnson, and you're talking about raising a minimum wage. You're talking about negotiating prescription drug prices. You're talking about this kind of stuff, and he's talking about defending the sedationists on January 6th. Yeah. You can do better. It's all you got to do. It's not that hard. But they all want to send out Twitter stuff. They all want to be clever. How much money can they raise? And like I say, somebody's got to wake up and say, hey, you know, first and foremost, I'm an American here. My country's in trouble. But people need to start acting like it.
The Wisconsin's interesting. And Charlie, you know, we've talked to this a little bit on the live stream. The Wisconsin is an existing, interesting example. There was a good, in addition to the Shore article, there was a good Dan Ball's article this morning about Wisconsin and how it kind of presaged our current polarization. And how it's really two states. I think this is what's driving this. Like, you look at the Wisconsin primary, me and Charlie have been talking about this. It's like these guys are talking on the Democratic side, you know, Barnes and Lazary and all them are, if you look at their Twitter feeds, you know, you'd think that they were running in Colorado, right? And it's just Wisconsin isn't Colorado. Right. And so, but the reason why they're doing that is because Wisconsin isn't really a purple state, right? It's like really blue people. And then a bunch of really red people, and then there's a very small number in the middle. But the problem is that small number in the middle matters. And if they look at the Republicans and say, oh, well, you know, Donald Trump might be kind of crazy, and I didn't like all Donald Trump stuff, but like we don't want the Democrats to be completely in charge of everything and you know advancing all this far left stuff. Then they're liable to lose Wisconsin, which is a very winnable state. And I'm a little bit, and I think that's frustrating to me when you get somebody like Ron Johnson.
Well, it is frustrating to me, and I don't know whether Johnson's going to run, but if he thinks there's going to be a big Republican wave here, I think he's more likely to run. If he thinks the Democrats are going to nominate somebody like Mandela Barnes, who's running sort of a Bernie-esque, very, very woke campaign, I think he'll run, because I think he'll perceive that that Barnes is exactly the wrong kind of Democrat to run, you know, in this particular cycle, and I think he's right. But I don't know. I thought for a moment that maybe Ron Johnson was going to back off from the crazy, that he was going to, you know, lay off the crazy pills, but that has not happened. If he did lay off the crazy pills, it would be an indication maybe he was serious, but I don't know. So, guys, can I flip the script for a moment?
Wait, I'm just sorry, really quick. Ron Johnson, I was like, did you see him talking about ivermectin and how Merck? I mean, he talk about the dude who's in the fucking fever swamps.
I know.
He's out there talking about how the drug companies are pushing the vaccine because they get better money than they get from the horse dewormer. Like he was saying that. He's saying that stuff on Fox. Like, this is gateway pundit level, like message board level material.
Okay, now that's a great segue, because what's happening is that the crazy is becoming crazier. So, but let me flip the script on this, because the Republicans have some problems too. You probably saw, you know, Politico playbook noting how many Republican candidates have like serious baggage issues, not just because they're crackpots, but they have domestic violence complaints against them. Donald Trump has weighed in. He endorsed Sean Parnell in this open Pennsylvania Senate race, and it turns out that Parnell had asked for a gag order on his estranged wife and her lawyer during their custody battle. She's filed two protective orders against him back in 2017 and 2018, pretty recent. And this has happened over and over again. You know, you've had Trump jumping into these Senate races, endorsing these flawed candidacies in Georgia. Herschel Walker, you've written about this, somebody who's, you know, faced domestic abuse allegations. Max Miller, the guy who's running for Congress in Ohio. And then there's Eric Greitens, who, I mean, you want to talk about some significant baggage that he's got. So there is that possibility that Donald Trump will use his endorsements to blow completely winnable Senate seats for Republicans. James, I mean, we've seen this over and over again, but I mean, I don't know, does this stuff matter anymore?
You know, it matters on the margins, and now races are won on the margins. I like the margins, all right? And crazy, my favorite is the woman from Colorado, Bob
Bobert. Lauren Bobert. Yeah, Bobert.
Yeah. Yeah, read how she and her husband met. Okay.
Okay. He was in a bowling alley. Was it not in a bowling alley?
Yeah, he was arrested for exposing himself to her.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, look. That,
just a man of the people, James. This whole, that's just my how things character. Do outside of your coastal elite bubble, all right? Yeah, like, guys right. just take out their dicks in a bowling alley.
Yeah,
just
say,
like,
that's just how it
happens. That's just marketing, you know? Hey, my favorite character is
Trash Al Odom.
Oh.
The guy... Corey Lewandowski, the woman that he basically tried to rape.
Yeah.
Groping her. These a lot of these people are just, I mean, we call them Louisiana, just really white trash. I mean, that's what they are.
The Lewandowski thing, and Charlie, I wrote, so when I wrote the Lewandowski Amazing. Article on Monday, which I really enjoyed writing.
I enjoyed reading.
You know, what I wrote at the end of that is like, look, the sexual assault, the dominance of women, like it is a feature, not a bug of Trumpism, right? Like, ooh. Like the Corey Lewandowski, everybody knows this has been happening for 5 years. I mean, like this was at a random fundraiser in Vegas at a Benihana, and this woman is getting assaulted, and two other donors over the course of the dinner come up to her and say, Corey's always like this. And it's like, so Corey's been getting away with this for a half decade. Because years. It's what they like in the Trump circles. And that's why Herschel Walker got endorsed. That's why Eric Greitens gets endorsed. That's why if you haven't watched the Sean Parnell video, I don't know about what James's super PAC plans are coming up here this cycle, but there's a wonderful, wonderfully horrific Sean Parnell video where he's talking like Archie Bunker. You know, it's like a down market Archie Bunker about how like women still like, you know, we need women to be back in the kitchen and men like their women to serve us. It's like 2021. And like this guy's running in Pennsylvania. This isn't Alabama. He's not trying to get the Nick Saban vote. It's a swing state.
Give me 30 seconds.
Okay.
are we gonna vamp here? Or are we just gonna cut this?
I don't know.
We are
gonna do it absolutely live. No, see, I look at this and in Trump world, you know, Donald Trump sitting down there in Mar-a-Lago and he goes, yeah, this sounds good. You know, is that really a problem? You know, I mean, it's not when you say that it's a feature, not a bug. I mean, there's a reason why these people are attracted to Trump world. Because nobody else would take them. I mean, in Earth 2.0, which I've cited in the past frequently, these people would be complete pariahs. Nobody.
All right, I'm back.
You know, nobody. Okay, you're back. Got something good for us?
Yeah, I ran out of coffee.
I thought you were running to get like. Okay, I have something here about Sean Parnell. This is going to blow your mind. Okay, so speaking of PTSD and feeling like we're caught in this time warp because it does feel like, you know, every time is recycling itself. Donald Trump, did you hear Donald Trump on Sean Hannity last night? He's playing
on Twitter.
He's playing his greatest hits. Let's play Donald Trump talking about, remember the whole thing about shithole countries? He was, you know, talking about we can't bring people here from shithole countries like Haiti. Unlike, for example, Norway, which apparently is definitely not a shithole country. I mean, you do the analysis here. But this is the former president of the United States last night on Sean Hannity.
So we have hundreds of thousands of people flowing in from Haiti. Haiti has a tremendous AIDS problem.
AIDS
a step beyond. AIDS is a real bad problem. So hundreds of thousands of people are coming into our country. And if you look at the stats, if you look at the numbers, if you look at just take a look at what's happening in Haiti, a tremendous problem with AIDS. Many of those people will probably have AIDS, and they're coming into our country, and we don't do anything about it. We let everybody come in.
With AIDS.
Sean, it's like a death wish. It's like a death wish for our country.
Okay, so don't turn that into a drinking game where you drink every time he says AIDS.
That's the mental acuity candidate. Right there.
So we're back to the coming down the golden escalator and talking about Mexican rapists. I mean, the guy is playing his greatest hits. Isn't
he? He did say that Vietnam, that unprotected sex during the 60s was his personal Vietnam. So I don't know. Maybe he's planning on having unprotected. I don't understand why it's a death wish for Donald Trump, you know, even if his racist anti-Haitian attack was true and that everybody had AIDS. I don't know why that would be a death wish for people in the country. I mean, he's just so trash. He's just trash.
Okay, James, this seems like it's a category thing. It's like Donald Trump saying they're bringing in all of these Haitians. Everybody gets in here, except, of course, for all the Haitians who don't get in here, but never mind. Right. And all these Haitians are going to come here, and they're just going to be, you know, fucking people and giving them AIDS, right?
Right.
I mean, black people, they're coming here, and they're going to be fucking around, and we're going to get AIDS. I mean, this kind of, you know.
Remember Ebola?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, we're all going to be dead.
Yeah, we're all
dead. The greatest fear in the world is black people are going to kill us all.
Yeah, caravans. Right? Caravans are coming, and they're coming for your women.
A caravan, and I don't. It's not going to stop. Not in my lifetime for sure, but not you and Tim's either.
Doesn't it though feel like we're back to some of the rhetoric that you would have heard in 1957 or 1958? And Donald Trump, I think, with his reptilian instinct, knows that that right now is what plays with the Republican base, right? So, Tim, I know you're compiling the lengthy list of all Republicans who were pushing back on that and objecting to that kind of rhetoric, right?
I am here. I'm turning the page right now. I'm going through. Oh, wait. I haven't seen any, actually.
Crickets, actually. Yeah. When I used to have my radio show, I used to have sound effects for crickets playing in the background. So, crickets.
I was... You know, talking to a Republican in good standing yesterday, which I don't do that much anymore. Now that we're on the outs, and this high ranking person, unfortunately, I can't say who it was, but they, I was asking why they don't ever comment on this sort of thing anymore. You know, they're talking about how the party's moving forward and how I just need to stop with my derangement syndrome and, you know, kind of get back on board because I'm like, when was the last time you said something about, and they're like, well, Donald Trump doesn't have any office anymore. Yeah. He doesn't have anything. So like they're playing the same game that they played for a half decade.
Nothing.
Well, I don't have to comment on everything. What about the why aren't you talking about the 3.5 trillion? And I was like, what are you talking about? We talk about that all the time.
Well, you called it a Frankenstein monster.
Yeah. So, I mean, these guys have no balls and they're sleepwalking. Or no, they're not sleepwalking. They're awake. They're woke walking right back into just letting that madman who just, you know, said the word AIDS 12 times in 9 seconds.
I lost track, but they're coming.
Be the party standard bearer.
AIDS.
That hangs over everything. And I just don't feel like there is enough of an appreciation about this. And I think it speaks to why the Republican Party is so crazy, but also the urgency of the Democrats to get their shit together. And that's why when we criticize, we do it with love. And we do it, you know, it's an act of love. We're trying to help everybody get better so we don't have to deal with this madman again.
Okay, speaking of madmen, I mentioned before how the crazy is getting crazier. I have one more soundbite for you guys. Tucker Carlson has a new conspiracy theory about Joe Biden. Can we just play that?
These are pictures of a fake White House set that the Biden administration has for some reason constructed across the street
all
from
sets are
the
fake.
Actual White House. It's in an auditorium at the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. Why go to the trouble? They already have a White House. Well, Stephen Miller spent the last 4 years in the White House as an advisor to Trump, and here's his explanation for it, because he would know.
Quote, he would know.
The reason Biden uses this bizarre virtual set for televised meetings and not an actual room like the East Room, the Cabinet, the Oval, the Roosevelt Sit Room, etc. There are a lot of rooms. The reason he does this is because it allows him to read a script directly from a face-on monitor and without teleprompter glass that can be seen on camera. Now, we can't verify that that's true, but it certainly sounds right. Joe Biden can't speak from the Oval Office because he's not sure what to say, so he has to read it all here. So that raises a much deeper question. The question is not, is Joe Biden mentally impaired? Obviously, he is, and again, we're not going to gloat over it. No, but a much more important question for the rest of us is, if he's not running the government, then who is? That's a real question.
George Soros.
Look, this is the delta between Tucker Carlson and Alex Jones is really small. This is Alex Jones stuff. Just go. I mean, say, why would you have a fake set? First of all, it's all sets are fake. So he can have that camera where he can like read directly from it. Like, well, that doesn't really explain why you need a set because you can use that camera anywhere. So what the hell's going on here? Come on. Guys, explain this to me because my head's hurting.
It's the Bilderbergers.
Yes, it is.
This has just it's been around since the 50s.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly. Who is it? I bet you it's a, you know, it's Soros. It's a cabal of Jewish bankers somewhere, you know.
With AIDS.
It's the highest rated show on TV. And it's the highest rated show on cable TV. You know, right? He's feeding the people what they want. It's like why the National Enquirer is at the checkout line, you know, not the New Yorker. When you were at the grocery store back in the 90s, right? That's what he's feeding it to them. And it's, I mean, it is when you do these focus groups, like on our quick plug for our focus group podcast by Sarah Longwell, which is wonderful. And you listen to these folks, everyone has been convinced of this, though. It is Alex Jones shit. It is crazy. But your median Republican voter, not your craziest Republican voter, your median Republican voter thinks that Donald Trump is an extremely strong and intelligent and bright man who went to Penn and was a wonderful businessman, and that Joe Biden is a, you know, dementia addled moron who is being managed behind the scenes by, you know, a globalist cabals of Jewish bankers, right? Like that's like
the lasers, median view. Space lasers.
Yeah, it's the median view. And so, you know, I mean, we can laugh, but like
that's the median view.
That's the idea that Trump is sharp and Biden is doing it because they keep beating this in. And these guys, you have to understand, they don't watch, you know, Joe. Like that is a ridiculous statement. If you actually watch Joe Biden, you know, do conversations. Now, we can all admit Biden's lost a step, but like it's not like he needs a screen to know what to say. Like he can communicate. He knows what's happening. But these people don't watch that. They just watch the Tucker Carlson clip of it. And for some reason, when Donald Trump vamps about Haitian with AIDS for 13 seconds, that doesn't raise any questions to them about his mental acuity.
Okay, so James, how do you message against crazy like this?
You know, he got 46 in 2016, and I think he got 47 in 2020. And first of all, when they indict him, the criminal charges are going to be staggeringly easy to understand. Will the hardcore crazies leave him? But it'll rattle it a little bit. You don't need to rattle, but about another 2 or 3% more, and you're able to run the table at that point. And
I want a unicorn for my birthday too. But
okay, this stuff is coming. The problem is I see it. Is they're nuts, and it's irredeemable. If a person, you know, doesn't get vaccinated, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do for you. I mean, just, but what are you doing? Is it? But there's a lot of people in this country that are like that. They're irredeemable. What the Democrats have to do is, and they can run a liberal message. It just has to be sane, and you know, get off of, you know, this faculty lounge language and just get out there and talk to people about things that matter and make an election about people's lives and not,
see,
you know, your life. They would do a lot better.
See, but this is the problem. So guys like Tim and I spent the last 5 years telling the same thing to Republicans. Like, you can be conservative, but just don't be crazy. And Republicans said, yeah, they'd rather be crazy. Yes. And so, right, pass on that. And now, James, you're doing the same thing, saying, hey, you can, you know, have the things you want, just don't be crazy. And, you know, the squad's going, yeah, pass. Yeah, we'd rather go, you know, blow things
in. How many certifiable, I wouldn't say themselves certifiable crazy, or people that go along with certifiable crazy ideas? You think in the House Republican caucus? The answer is a lot.
Yeah, I know. 100, right? 100, a lot. 130, 40.
130. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. On the real lefties in the Democratic caucus are probably 17. Mm. Right? I mean, both parties, right. This is both side, you know, true. Both siderism. Well, you know, James, yeah, you know, we got some crazies, but let's admit you got crazies too. Yeah, you got five times more crazies than we do. The problem is that the 17 exert more, they're in the news more, the press follows them more, they're being put as an equal titanic struggle within the Democratic Party, where they literally lose every election that's not in a congressional district, doesn't have a Cook PVI of +30. I mean, come on. You win a seat in central Boston, you've done nothing.
Yeah.
You've done nothing. Yeah. Oh, so, you win one in the Bronx, but you've done nothing. Go win a race. Go to Wisconsin and win a statewide race. Then I'm impressed with you.
Yeah, good. Good.
But until you do that, I'm not impressed.
Okay, so let's close out on a different note. You wanted to do a little bit of what? You wanted a little bit of rah-rah here, Tim, for
I have two items. So we're with James, so just, I mean, right. You know, me, Charlie, me and you can just, you know, talk about how bad the Orange Man is any week. So I want to just kind of leverage our expertise here. So I want to hear James on Terry McAuliffe, because I'm getting a little worried. Getting a little worried about his friend Terry McAuliffe. Okay. Right. And then we need to just give the people what they want and discuss what's wrong with LSU football. So those are my okay, two Terry, final topics.
Okay. I did two fundraisers with Terry, like one last Thursday, and then one Monday in New York. It's tighter than Dick's hat band. All right, it's 40,
tighter than what?
What?
Tighter than Dick's hat band. That's just an expression. It's just tight. Okay.
I'm going to need you to spell that.
I'm going to write that out. Dick's hat
band. Okay. It's very tight. He would obviously be helped if they had some kind of a deal in Washington that they announced prior to November 2nd. They have some really good negatives on Youngkin. I think they got more coming. He's working like a rented mule. And, at the end of the day, the consequences of the race are going to be enormous, because if he loses, then a guy like Ron Johnson say, well, you know what, I think I'll run.
That's exactly right.
Right? And it's going to have a lot to do with recruitment and retirements in the House.
This is right.
And the Senate. This is a big deal, and it's close. And I can't tell you how many emails I've sent out trying to help raise money at, Zoom events, anything like that. But I'm not cocky. I'm not confident. I'm marginally confident.
Democratic strategists, not you, James, but your brethren are always panicking. And before the California race, I sort of had the view that everybody's panicking unnecessarily. This is crazy. Like, Gavin's going to be fine. He ends up winning by more than he did in 2018. I'm not saying the same thing's going to happen in Virginia, but I mean, Joe Biden won by 10 points, right? I mean, the pullout today has McAuliffe up 4. Like, what is it? Why? What are people seeing that is making them so nervous about it? Is it people abandoning him in Northern Virginia? Like, what is it? Excitement?
Now, what you see is history that in the last 44 years, the party that wins the White House comes into the White House, they lose Virginia. All right, and you're seeing that they are, right now, gassed up. Look, it could revert to a norm, and Terry could win by 4 or 5 points. I'm not, but right now, the better data that I see, I think it's, these Democratic posts are so conservative. You just can't imagine how much they squeeze these numbers. But I'd rather run a race and tell people you got a lot at stake here. There's a lot to be concerned about, and that's the kind of nature of it. But again, I'm not a total pessimist. I've laid out an idea for you. I think the Democrats could actually do pretty good in 2022. But Virginia's going to be tight, no doubt about it. And the California thing was, the press loved that story. Yeah. And they stampeded it, and somebody did an analysis. I think it was one poll or
one
two
poll,
polls.
There's
nothing. Every 3 days, the press has to run Dems in disarray story. I've been dealing with that shit since the 80s.
Well, the Dems make that easy. Okay, so Tim, let's give people what they want, which is which is less than 15 seconds.
15 seconds on LSU football. That is such BS. Everybody's
that's
fast
what the
forward.
Public
Everybody's
wants.
Fast forward through this podcast. They're putting us on 2x speeds. They can't even understand what James is saying on 2x. They're just waiting until they hear Ogeron. They just want to know what's happening with Coach Ogeron. Look, we won the national championship 2 years ago. It was just a beautiful moment right before the pandemic started. It was, they caught lightning in a bottle. But since then, they're 8-7. What's going on, James? I'm worried about Coach O. Is he going to survive the year even?
Well, if we don't learn how to block, he's not going to survive anything. We can't block anybody. And they call it blocking and tackling. Actually put blocking first. and that's the issue. And look, big surprise, LSU football is a, you got to win. I think Coach O understands that. Everybody else understands that. And he better win at Kentucky and get some momentum going here.
I'm down there in 2 weeks. I hope we can hang out in person, James.
You're going to the Florida game?
Yeah, I'm going to the Florida game. We can do some selfies, and maybe I can bring some positive mojo to the mix here.
We need some mojo.
Okay, so now what the public really wants is a little discussion about America's team. The Milwaukee Brewers are in the playoffs. Oh, yeah. Milwaukee home to the NBA champion Bucks, about to be home to the World Series champion Milwaukee Brewers. Some just great stories out there, some great pitchers. I mean, Corbin Burns. I mean, come on, James. I mean, Corbin Burns. Look, this guy.
I got blown away.
I mean, he's Cy Young. You know, he's got a lock, right?
I don't know who I'm pulling for. I kind of like to see Dusty win one.
No.
Yeah, well, Craig Counsell is the best manager in baseball. Absolutely. I mean, that's almost a given. I don't think many people even argue that, do they?
No, I don't know. You know, the thing about, you know, Corbin Burns, who is so awesome, I could go through all of his stats. He was actually picked in the fourth round of the MLB junior amateur draft, you know, back in the day, fourth round. And he's just awesome. So anyway, America's team.
I have
team,
to tell you just really quick.
Don't mention the LSU guy, Kevin Gausman at San Francisco. He's had a hell of a year, too.
All right. So
I aspire to be James Carville. This is my one, like, moment of for all of James Carville's successes, electing a president, all of his, we could run down his list. The thing that I most admire is last year at this time, I was watching MSNBC, and James Carville was on, and it was in the middle of a baseball playoff game, and he's in a hotel room, and the TV is on behind him. So he's on TV on his laptop, but the baseball playoff game is behind him, and it is playing live on his TV, so he can kind of check in on it while the hosts are chattering.
James is genuine. This is real America. Hey, Tim, you know how you can achieve that level?
Well, how?
Just when you do one of your MSNBC hits, when you're asked about how terrible Republicans are and everything, you just have it on in the background. You can just do it. You have the technology.
Do I have? But I know. But do I have the kind of stature to pull that off? I just don't know that I do.
Hey,
I
think stay tuned.
Guys, I'm going to give you one piece of video to watch. Watch Warren Morris home run. And notice the shortstop for the University of Miami. It's Alex Cora. Mm. He just falls on the ground in grief and just starts beating the infield. But it's really worth watching it to watch the reaction of the Red Sox manager back, I guess, 1997 College World Series.
Right.
One of great moments in LSU sports history.
I'm going to look it up right now. Gentlemen, thank you so much for getting us into the weekend. Tim Miller and James Carville.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Gil. And I said, call me when you get down to Louisiana, okay?
I will. Are you going to be down there? We don't know. It's signed off.
Yeah, we don't know. Hey, so, thank you all for listening to this weekend's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.